So we're here at Fringe Central at the start of the Fringe, and I'm going to preface this interview with a couple of things. One is, go back a couple of hundred years, and the writer Goethe, who wrote Faust, wrote a fairy tale. Actually, it's called The Green Snake and the Beautiful Lily. And a part of the quest in that story is somebody can't move on with their quest unless they answer some riddles. First question was, what is the most precious metal? And the correct answer was gold. What is more beautiful than gold? Light. And then the final question, very surprising answer, is what is quicker than light? Conversation, the most refined, beautiful thing. A book came out just over a year ago, a bestseller by Sherry Turkle, an academic from the US, called Reclaiming Conversation, really about when we've lost that, we've lost society. And so, you know, that brings us up to what she says in her book, that the realm of the little white lie, of exaggeration, of hype, you know, not just the corporation, but government, the world of PR, has basically made us lose conversation. And so I've deliberately not said, as I introduce our two interviews here, Jean Ann Douglas and Eric John Meyer, the title of their show until now, which is Obfuscation. And I'm going to invite one of you to say why you think my introduction's relevant to why you're here at the Fringe.
It's very relevant. Obfuscation is a play that's all about turning language against the purpose of communication and using it to manipulate, using it to obfuscate, which means to make confusing, to cloud a subject or an idea. So it's very much playing with the strategies that corporations and politicians use to talk endlessly without saying anything, or muddy the facts until it becomes difficult to say the truth, because words have, in a sense, lost their meaning because of the way they use them. And yeah, I mean, conversation is based on a set of agreements that we want to come to mutual understandings. Mm-hmm. And what they do essentially is sort of manipulate those rules or break them and hold you to them so that also that they can manipulate you.
And that's become so pervasive. I mean, we can fire the correct shots, you know, particularly under a banner called Civil Disobedience at the Fringe, which I know you guys are part of. We can fire that at government. We can fire that at Trump. We can fire that at Mark Zuckerberg. But can we fire it also at the Fringe makers who are sending us emails at Fringe Review to tell me, you know, that every show here is amazing and groundbreaking? Including yours?
Well, our amazing groundbreaking show will show you that anyone can use these tactics. And I think, sure, you can make the argument that we all use them to some extent in daily life, but I think it's less about following or not following the rules and more about the spirit of what you are trying to do when you're engaging with someone else. Are you trying to listen to them? Are you trying to tell them what you think, or are you trying to tell them what they think? And I think in some of those emails, in the case of some of those emails, you are trying to tell people what they think, but it's people are on to that game. So
slightly we are. So Jean-Anne, how did this piece get made?
So Eric and I have been making work together for the last 7 years. We're based in New York, and when we first met, we started making theater together that we put on in the back of a box truck, where we turn the back of the truck into a 16-seat venue, park it somewhere in a relatively undisclosed location, and give people who purchase tickets directions to where to find us on the night of the show. And so when we made this piece, we were making it for that environment of secrecy and people needing to try to find us. And, you know, we wrote it before our country elected, the United States elected our current president. But we're thinking a lot about ways that, you know, post 9/11 in the United States, the discourse and politics really broke down, because we were stuck so much trying to get people to believe in patriotism, and then, you know, confusing patriotism with particular acts that the government wanted to carry out. So using that breakdown of discourse and how that felt, Eric mostly wrote this very original play that's about these two characters, not stuck in any particular United States government environment or anything like that, but in their own situation, having a breakdown of communication with each other, feeling oppressed by the outside world and how people communicate there. So it is a very political play without being directly about any particular politics or particular side of politics.
And I guess two sides to this question, just in terms of why we focus on the theatre making rather than the writing, which we'll come to, is what particularly does theatre afford as a possibility here that others, you know, forms of expression don't? Why does theatre make this a good thing to explore?
Yeah, I think that there's a real rawness in theater that doesn't exist in other art forms of being looked at directly in the face by someone who's trying to communicate something to you. And something that's always been really important to us is the full experience that people have when they come into the theater, whether it be snacks that are given out to them, like the location of where the theater is found, the way that you're treated once you're in there and the ways that we interact with you or don't. And that person-to-person interaction, I think, speaks so much to, you know, what our play is about and the things that we care about, is that the more we get further and further away from face-to-face communication, the more, you know, opportunities there are for manipulation, for truth to be obscured. And there's a real truth to person-to-person communication that I think is very important.
And in terms of the physical staging in a box truck with just 16 people, I mean, I guess there's nowhere to hide.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was always, this performance has always been a lot about towing the line of making the audience uncomfortable versus not wanting to scare them off. And, you know, we really do, you know, make a lot of eye contact with folks and make them feel like they're experiencing the same thing that we are.
In terms of the journey of the writer, I'm always fascinated with that, what's sometimes called from page to stage, or in this case, from page to box truck as well. Take me back to the blank page moment.
Well, so this is a play that Jean-Anne and I really co-conceived, and then we were working on multiple projects at the time, and she took over writing one, and I took over writing this one. But so the initial inspirations for the play include a Republican pollster and sort of phrase smith named Frank Luntz, who is very successful. He was the man who came up with the term death tax for, you know, estate tax, and Arctic exploration for meaning drilling for oil in Alaska. And he has a book called Words That Work, where he explains that what he's doing is all very wholesome, and that he's, you know, it's not what you say, it's what people hear, which is a wonderful phrase that he uses to euphemistically say, tell people what they want to hear. And so it was that coupled with this series of clubs that have, I think they're international, called Toastmasters,
yeah.
Where people go to learn how to become better public speakers. And
well, that's big in the U.S., isn't it? That's a big branded thing.
Yes, it is. Yeah, they're all over. And they have videos, and they show people practicing speech making, and people have to get up and tell jokes. And there's a lot of routine and sort of ritual built into these things to, you know, make people sort of come out of their shells. And that became sort of the inspiration for the form that we take with this seminar, where you're learning, you know, it's fun, and it's also disturbing and unsettling at the same time. And, so we sort of mashed those together, and that's how it started.
And did you then kind of channel a script in 24 hours? Was this notebooks that turned into a draft? How did it get written?
You know, it took a while, because they have a very particular way of speaking, the two seminar hosts. And so
Sorry, just to be clear, so this is in the form of a seminar, isn't it?
Yes. What we tell people when we're flying is that it's a play that is posing as an illegal language seminar.
Right.
And they have a very particular way of speaking and interacting with audience that it took a while for me to find. So I was sort of stuck refining the first page for a while until I really got to know the world and the characters, and then it sort of unlocked for me, and I could see what they were doing, what they were about, and and the different sort of exercises they would take people through and all that.
Yeah. But also just in terms of, you know, a line where at one extreme we're all looking back, you know, just actually in this room people would say they felt manipulated by the Brexit vote here. Mm-hmm. You know, they felt they weren't on both sides. They were there was a lot of obfuscation. When people asked questions, they didn't get direct answers. They were lied to. Somewhere at the other extreme is, how are you? I say to my wife or son, and they go, fine, when they don't really feel fine. Mm-hmm. And when they're secretly hoping I might ask further. And somewhere in the middle are all the PRs here at the Fringe who feel that all the emails they're sending are pretty harmless. You know, they're just trying to get audience, but they're full of exaggeration and lies. And, mm-hmm. you know, in the end, is this all part of the same disease? Or is it just the bad guys of Toastmasters and government that we need to aim at?
I think that one of the things that I love so much about this play is that it does not assert that the two instructors are entirely good or entirely bad, that there's a lot of slipperiness to, like, they're doing some good work, and also, yes, they are using these tools. And, you know, the I think that people are not fully good or fully evil, and we all use manipulation to what we think are good ends, and sometimes we screw up and use it to bad ends. And I think that what I would love for people to get out of it is to see the ways that they use obfuscation and manipulation and language in their own lives, and to see the similarities of how they do it with their partner or their family, and how the government does that to us, or PR people at the Fringe do that to them. That yes, it is all similar, and it's not... you can't entirely just point fingers and pull yourself outside of it.
So your audience are going to take a hard look in the mirror at themselves from this.
And hopefully laugh.
But that is, you know, part of art has also been that hard truths are sometimes only delivered through theatre. And when mm-hmm. theatre is entertaining, it can be actually all the more powerful for that.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I think humour is one of the best delivery mechanisms for, like, dissidents and... all those hard truths, yes.
I mean, it's still at the start of the Fringe, but have you noticed any kind of difference in reaction from the UK, the Scottish audience, to a US audience?
So far, no. It is just the start for us. I think that UK audiences just delight in wordplay so much, which is a thing that's been really fun to... in our planning, I'm bringing it over, too, that we know this play is just so... delicious in the ways that we play with language, and everyone over here just connects with that in a way that's more heightened, I think, than in the United States.
We all do to an extent, but do US people, in what's gone on in, you know, say the elections recently, maybe it's similar, do we expect obfuscation now so much that we just don't even challenge it?
I think so. I think absolutely. I mean, a thing that is talked about a lot now as a completely legitimate subject is optics, which is essentially how well or poorly did you obfuscate. And that now people will criticize each other not on the substance itself of what you're doing, but you didn't make it look good enough. And that in itself is now, it can be a ding against you. Yeah, I think we are aware of the tactics that are being used on us, but they still can be very effective, because a huge element of what we respond to is emotional, not logical. You know, so Kellyanne Conway, everyone knows what she's doing when she changes the subject immediately and when she's asked a question. But if she's saying things you like, you don't really mind so much. And it's true on both sides. I don't mean to keep picking on the right, but I'm a theater person.
And as a theater person here at the Fringe, have you let go of the script now?
Let go in what sense?
Is it printed, we now do it, or are you making changes as you do each performance?
We've made a few tweaks, because we're no longer in a truck. We are now in a different site-specific space. We're in a hotel conference room. So there are certain references to where we are that needed to be changed in order to make sense of that.
But that's a good place to be, a hotel conference room, isn't it?
Yeah, we really like the space we're in. It feels very small and anonymous, kind of secret. Like you could be walking into a secret space that people don't necessarily know or isn't necessarily sanctioned, you know, and that's part of the part of what we want to give audiences.
But just, I'm into the geeky questions of, okay, so you've chain space, it's very different from a box truck. So what have you had to adapt?
So it's a bit about, you know, the journey of the audience and to get there. That when we were in a box truck, it was so much about how they found us and being able to hear the world happen outside of the truck and have that be a part of the piece. And so now the piece is a bit more about, okay, we're all in here together in this safe space where no one can find us for a little bit. And now let's have that experience. So we had to make some adjustments to bring in the terror of being found out, where when we were performing in the truck, you know, if a car drove by or someone did something outside, we could use that in our performance. But we've had to, adjust how we discover that in the piece of the scariness of the outside world.
Final question, maybe to both of you, to Eric, the writer, is a bit of a tough question in a way, so I don't mind you pausing if you want to think about it. But, you know, this is a piece of potentially disruptive theatre. You can enjoy it, but, you know, this is suggesting that there's a better way to be. So, you know, what does good look like in the world for you, you know, in the direction this play intends?
A lot more listening than is that in your engagement, you know, listening more than you talk, I think, and when you talk from the heart.
Yeah. So is the heart the place of authenticity, of truthfulness?
Yeah, and I think, you know, a certain amount of obfuscation is not necessarily malevolent, as long as your heart is in the right place. Well, now that takes you down a slippery slope.
Yeah.
Because can't the heart, for example, be so worried about it, our child, you know, showing us their first painting? We don't say that's a piece of shit, do we? We lie.
No, you just find the good parts about it. That's a great use of color, for instance. You really understand lines. You know, but I think you can also say that's beautiful and I'm so proud of you, son. And I don't think that that is, you know, I don't think you're making the world a worse place by doing that.
Right.
But I think that...
But isn't that a form of benevolent obfuscation?
I want to say yes, but, well, here's part of it, I think, is that obfuscation becomes a real problem when you're dealing in what should be serious discourse.
Which is like quality conversation.
Which is like we're trying to get somewhere, we're trying to make an important decision that has impact on our lives. That's when obfuscation really becomes an issue, whether it's in relationships or it's in politics or whatever. So if your son was asking you for feedback on his painting, then, you know, maybe you could say, this is really wonderful. Why don't you try this or that? I don't know. We don't have kids. but, you know, I think that's when it really becomes an issue is when you are taking advantage of someone's attempt to be heard and be spoken with honestly.
So that links, I mean, there was a writer called Bernard Levergood from the Netherlands who won an award-winning prize for a book called Developing Communities, and he talks about something that, I think he called at one point moral imagination or moral technique, where what you say and what you do doesn't compromise the freedom of anybody else. It actually never goes there.
What you say or do does not
happen. It always holds in mind the freedom of someone else to respond. It never bites away, it never tries to diminish their freedom to act or think.
So, wait, is he saying that no matter what you do, like whatever you do does not diminish other people's freedom?
Yeah, I shouldn't say something that kind of manipulates you into not having your full choices, not having the full picture, makes you give an answer that you may not have given had you had more information available to you, which I withhold from you, for example.
Well... Yeah, I mean, I agree with that.
Yeah, I think so much of what our play is in response to is like soundbite culture and response culture, where people feel like they need to have something that is pithy and short and concise and clear, and that the world is losing a bit of its grayness of allowing that you can hold two contradictory ideas in your head at the same time and wrestle with that. And a lot of the play, I think, is in response to that, and making a case for complexity.
So this 20-minute interview has not been a soundbite. but Obfuscation sounds like a fascinating and important piece of work here at the Fringe. So thanks both for talking to us, Jean-Anne and Eric. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.